Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Well, hey, everybody, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. Thank you for all the kind comments surrounding my absence from YouTube and the true crime community lately. Stick around for a minute and I'll update you on where I've been, and we'll join on a quick chat about cults. Well, it's going to be Thanksgiving this week in the United States, and I wanted to express my appreciation to all of you for the past 3 years of friendship and association. Now, I'm not going anywhere, but I have been incredibly busy. In fact, I've been living in an airplane, and it feels like it's just nonstop right now. I just got home, and I took a few moments to cut this video before heading out of town with my family to a warmer climate. I'm going to be with my wife, my children, and grandchildren for the holiday. Then I'm off to Austria and Germany for most of December. Now I'm going to try to cut a video here and there, and I'll be watching for any book orders that you're sending in for Christmas. So please get your book orders in quickly so that I can get them shipped. I'm not going to send anything after December 19th. Now, today, I wanted to take a minute and congratulate my buddy Frank over at Quite Frankly. He just hit 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, and I'm marking that milestone by sharing an interview, frankly, at his request, frankly. I'm sharing the interview that I did with him a few weeks ago about cults, and I hope that you enjoy our discussion, and I hope that you'll check out his channel. Thanks again, Frank, and let's jump into this video, and please enjoy the holiday season.
Now that I've talked your ear off, let's go and talk about our wonderful guest this evening, Mr. Mike King. He is the creator and host of Profiling Evil on YouTube and podcast. He also has the podcast Mapping Evil with Mike King in Southeast Asia. Today, he appears regularly on Court TV, the Dr. Phil Show, News Nation, and other mainstream news and entertainment programs. He served a 5-year term on the board of directors of the Cold Case Foundation before stepping down in 2021. Mike has worked with law enforcement around the world on real-time crime, intelligence, and fusion and emergency communications. His 28 years of law enforcement includes chief of staff to the Weber County attorney and a police officer in Ogden, Utah, but overall has been assisting with law enforcement operations for over 4 decades now. He joins us tonight. I've been looking forward to this for many weeks. Mike King, welcome to the show.
Hey, what a pleasure to be with you, Frank. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours. I can't wait to jump into this. So, you know, you're pretty soon you'll be going on a half a century's work doing this detective work, all kinds of things. Do you still remember the first case that you took on?
You know, I do. Of course, there were cases as a patrol officer where you end up responding to a burglary or a missing child. And then as you kind of evolve into detectives, you get additional kinds of cases. But I'll never forget my very first case was a little boy who walked away from a home. And we spent all night looking for him, and thankfully found the kid. And it's the stories like that that really stick with you. But on that very same night, a kid that went to high school with us was serving as a jailer in the community where I live, and he was murdered on his way home from work, and I ended up being the first officer on the scene at his homicide. So those kind of things stick with you. You never lose them. and you always think about them and wonder what their lives might have been like.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, as time passes by, the backdrop for what's going on around us, really makes you wonder. Obviously, there's individual tragedies. Then you start wondering how much of it is connected, whether it be a ripple through culture or something else that is just making things go sideways. And then, now that's you as a patrol officer. What about like getting actually into? Did you go into detective work at that point? Did you get what was that transition like coming off the beat and then actually having a case assigned to you to look into?
Well, you know, I was lucky. I served as a SWAT officer for a number of years, and that's a great testosterone time in a person's life because you're blowing up things, you're kicking doors in, you're shooting all the time, and of course you're working with a team of other SWAT officers that you have nothing but trust and utmost respect for. But then as I started moving into investigations, I went to work for the county attorney, I actually took up an investigative squad, and we were buying stolen cars and running sting operations. And so we were having the time of our life. I mean, that was real police work to be out and be in the trenches and digging things up. And that kind of led me into this crazy case of cults and child sexual abuse and adult sexual abuse that I never planned on doing. But it kind of evolved and became a hallmark of my career.
That became the subject matter for your book, Deceived. Now, you were responsible. This is all focused around your breaking up a major polygamous cult in Utah called the Zion Society. You published that book about it. Can you give us the highlights of that case, starting with how you caught the scent of the whole plot itself? Who came forward? How did this all starting to unfurl?
You know, Frank, that was crazy. And like I say, I was running this undercover sting task force. And I walked into the county attorney's office one day. I was probably about 12 years into my career by this point. So I had seen a few things and I'd been in a lot of different kinds of circumstances. And the receptionist said, "Hey, can you talk to this woman sitting over in the corner? She's been waiting for a couple of hours to meet with an investigator and there's nobody available." So I was the last rung on the ladder, I believe. And I walked over and it's this beautiful 21-year-old girl with jet black hair. And I mean, she was dressed up to the T's. I walked over to introduce myself and she stood up real confidently and she said, "Hi, my name is Aaron Anderson and I've been involved in a cult that's sexually abusing children. Do you have a minute to talk to me?" Jeez. And like you might imagine, I mean, I tried to act like I hear this kind of thing all the time, but I was absolutely blown away. That led me into understanding what was going on and launched an investigation that took thousands of hours, ultimately resulted in us taking 70 police officers and raiding the compound, hitting 14 homes at once to try to collect evidence, to take people into custody, to take children into protective custody. Because this was a group of about 120 adults that were sexually abusing 32 children, and they were stockpiling weapons and ammunition, and they had this doomsday mentality. So it was an incredibly pivotal moment in my career.
I want to get into so much of that, especially the cult lead. I want to talk about the cult formation from top down. But as far as when you're learning about the who, what, where, why, when, what's the why? You say the doomsday mentality, you have the ammunition, you have this secluded compound. Obviously, there is a religious ritual aspect to all this, but where does the abuse of children, where's the value in that? Is it for spirit conjuring reasons, or is it, I mean, what? Did you find out motive? How much?
Yeah, I think that the thing that we had to do initially was, number one, figure out if this woman was crazy or not, if she was truly telling the truth, because she was actually implicating herself in this crime spree, Frank. She said, "I'd been in this cult and I had been involved in the abuse of children." She was prepared to take whatever would happen to her, including going to prison to clear her conscience and save these kids. So as we started digging into it, the idea is that you don't want to take just one form of evidence or one person's testimony. So you start digging around the periphery and you start trying to figure out, is there physical evidence, forensic evidence, maybe eyewitness testimony, and can these things corroborate each other and really help you bring a case together? But as you're doing this, you're trying to understand the philosophy of the group, what the ideology is. And, you know, there are lots of cults out there. Somebody that loves the Dodgers could be accused of being a cultish follower of the Dodgers. So what we really focus on when we look at these cults is a destructive cult, something that's taking away the rights of others, someone that's really impacting the lives of others. And as we looked into this cult, we started recognizing that they were people with like mindsets. So they wanted a polygamous type lifestyle. They wanted to have multiple wives, and they wanted to be able to carry on outside of the laws of what law would say was a traditional marriage at the time. They had people that were doomsdayers that believed the end of the world was coming and that they needed to stockpile weapons and be prepared for this Armageddon that might come. And you always seem to have these extremists, these religious zealots who are elitists and think that they have all of the light and knowledge that is needed and nobody else seems to have it. And then, of course, you got the followers, the people that are seeking a support system, or the people who just frankly need direction in all things. And there are people out there that can't even make a decision on their own. They want somebody just to tell them what to do rather than be responsible for the choices they make.
And I can see that, you know, somebody wants to have more than one wife. Somebody wants to, or somebody thinks that there's a comet coming that's going to whisk us all away and we need to get our, get our stuff in order and put on our sneakers and put the roll of quarters in our pockets and all that stuff. But, you know, but where does the utility in destroying the lives, the innocence of children come in? Obviously the first thing I go to is, you know, say if it's satanic ritual abuse, I mean, there is very ceremonial. There's a lot of ceremonial value in destroying children like that. But that just seems like the last thing that you would want to do if you thought that you were actually about to hitch a ride on a comet to heaven is to destroy the life of a child beforehand.
Yeah, it's interesting. And as we looked at this particular cult leader, and his name was Arvin, what we started to realize as we were looking into his background was that he actually wasn't this self-proclaimed prophet that he was putting himself out to be. In reality, he was a predator and a pedophile, and that he was building a religion to justify what he already knew was wrong. And it started out with basic lusts and led toward this idea of polygamy in his case. And some people may argue that polygamy is a completely laudable thing, and I don't want to even get into that battle other than to say if people are being required, forced, compelled to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do, that steps over the line from deviant kinds of behaviors into criminal behaviors. And this guy started saying, hey, I want more wives. Well, as his church grew, he got more wives. He grew to the point that he had 28 wives himself. And there were several other men in the cult who had polygamous families that they were starting. But then his ideology started to get a little wackier as his perversions got uglier. And he said that he received revelation from his God. And I hope you noticed I said his God, because I don't believe it's the same God that many of us believe in. But his God was telling him that the women should now have sexual relationships with each other, because he was now 61 years old. And I don't know if he was unable to take care of the needs that some had, or if it was just his perversion getting out of control. But then this thing continues to canker, and he comes up with new revelation that says his God believes that the children should be involved. And he was sexually assaulting children as young as 2 years old at the time of his arrest.
You know, we all, there's a lot of us. I know that you are very, very, when it comes to your work, you're very by the book. You don't engage in speculation, conspiracy theory, but I love conspiracy theory. And, you know, and I also just through observation theorize a lot that, that kind of the way that you're describing this grooming of people into a situation where a thought of someone who is a pedophile that wants to normalize deviant behavior with a smaller group so that you can eventually get to the point where you can live the way you want to live out in the open and have nobody say anything about it. I believe that kind of thing happens on a national and international level. And I think that the cultural degradation that we're witnessing all the time is we're on a slippery slope towards something like that. But you know, what you're talking about right now, it reminds me a lot about the testimony of people who struggled to get away from the Church of Scientology, as well as a lot of what we know about the People's Temple with Jim Jones and how he upped the ante all the time, where there are just little people who get roped in, blackmailed, extorted, and the abuse comes in many different forms. But can you talk about the formation of a cult from the top down? So from the standpoint of the cult leader, how does one create a foothold with people usually? Is it usually a preacher who breaks away from a legitimate congregation and then takes a small foundation with them? Is it street evangelizing? Is it mail marketing? How did this start? How did he find his first three disciples?
Well, so for this guy, what a great question, because when we went back and looked at his processes, we came up with a couple of recruiting and retention kind of strategies that I have now tested against other cults throughout the last 35 years, where first and foremost, the thing is they call it search, this process of getting out. And for most, it starts with family members, those that they can control, like a father who has control over children and instills in them a certain ideology or belief system. Then it kind of spreads into friends and associates, and those become the foundational part. And if you offer people something that they can't get otherwise, especially people who have some rather mundane life that they're living, or they're at a crisis point at that point where maybe they feel like they don't have any support system somewhere, and all of a sudden someone cares, then they can bring those people in. And, you know, when I started all this, I used to think people are idiots that join cults. It's absolutely not the truth, Frank. Cults are filled with educated people, people who have money, people who are poor. But most often it's going to be somebody that can bring something to the cult, whether it's finances or property or a capability that's going to help them grow. And in Arvin case and in the Zion Society case, once he got that core group of members, then he had them go out and start their recruiting process. And what they did is they figured out the perfect victim to bring into the cult. Arvin wanted them to go out because his preference was having these harems of women and seek out women who were in vulnerable situations. Mm. And they would then start inviting them to come and go to a movie night or something, or he'd offer assistance. He'd find a mom who had just gone through a divorce and was scared to death as she faced trying to figure out where she was going to live and how she was going to get a job and pay for her kids and keep them in a safe environment. And he'd say, hey, we got all that for you. You can just come and we're going to take care of you because we've been through this before. We know what you're going through and we want to help. And people get sucked in because they are so incredibly vulnerable. And it makes me always think of a quote that was made by Margaret Singer. Dr. Singer was this amazing individual who studied cults all her career. And she said, you know, we believe that people can be led to buy almost anything. And you think about that in the advertising world.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, but in addition to buying almost anything, people can be led to believe almost anything. And then she taught this really important principle that cults know that if you knew what you were in for in the beginning, what you were in for and why, you'd never join. It's as simple as that. So it's all about that search and guys that you put in.
Yeah, well, that perfectly answers the next question I had, because it's one thing to wonder about how does leadership put together the structure of what will be their church or whatever the hell they're trying to put together. But, you know, how do you find people to join cults to do, you know, is it usually people with diabolical intentions from the beginning, or is it that their willingness to commit evil evolves over time through certain types of, I mean, perfect example is the girl who implicated herself to be able to break the story. I mean, obviously that is somebody who never intended to hurt children, but however many months or years she's in, she realized what her life had become. And now if there's any chance of making amends, for the rest of it, there's gotta be the piper's gotta get paid. So it's just crazy to think that it could sneak up on you, but I guess it has snuck up on people before.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it makes me think of one of the things that I learned as I was running this statewide task force on ritual crime for the Attorney General. By the way, I was chief of staff in the Attorney General's office, not at the county level, although I guess I could be kind of called that too there. But one thing that I figured out was, especially in dealing with polygamist organizations or other closed societies, is you really got two buckets. You have these generational groups, especially when you're dealing with polygamy, where these children are raised with an ideology and a belief system. They never had anything different than what they're living. And to infiltrate and to extract and to change and to deprogram somebody who is generationally involved in cult behavior is next to impossible, versus groups like the Zion Society that were convert-based. They came into it, but they still had in the back recesses of their mind a memory of a support system or right and wrong or this isn't right. And that made a huge difference in this particular case, because we watched as these people went through this process of recruitment, that they would then start to separate them from everything that was of some form of support. They would tell them you can have no more relationship with your family. They would, in this group and in many cults, strip them of all their identity, sometimes even changing their names, like in Heaven's Gate or some of the other cults that you've mentioned. They would strip them of anything that provides identity, including things like wedding rings or personal possessions, photographs. And as they did that, they could start this grooming process where they would subtly introduce concepts that had a ring of truth, but then would start to bring in these weird things. And over time, as people push back and say, hey, I'm not comfortable with that, they would then come in with such emotional battering and disengagement that the people would fall back in line in order to have that support system that they'd grown to rely upon. And that's how a guy goes from, I'd never do that, to thinking, well, maybe it's not that bad. If God wants me to do it, maybe I can. And the best analogy I can think of is you don't boil a frog by throwing him in boiling water.
Yeah. Well, yeah, well, that one gets around a lot these days. So when we talk about let's talk about societal conditions. What may be contributing to this, to violent, this type of violence? I mean, we talk about serial killers, ritualistic murder. Are there any hard markers for you that you see in society that would make this become more and more prevalent? And do you believe that it is more prevalent in society today than when, you know, maybe back in the late 70s or so?
You know, I don't know if I believe that it's a bigger problem today. I believe that some contributing factors are bigger today. We watched this happen as the internet started to become a big thing through the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. And we saw the influence that pornography had on the fantasy that predators would start to create in their mind. And there's, you know, it's a really weird thing when you think about this. For any of your listeners out there that are like Bible readers, the Bible says that the world had to be created spiritually first and then physically created. Crime's exactly the same way. Before someone acts out and does something, it has to be created in the mind. And in the mind, they work through justifying whether it's something they can pull off and be successful at or not. And then they continue to fantasize about that. And the thing about fantasy is fantasy will always be cooler than reality. And so when these people finally act out and try something, it never works out like they want. A follower is upset and says, this doesn't feel right. Or a child that's being sexually assaulted is saying, this isn't right. And the predator has to go back and in their fantasies, fix whatever was going wrong and try it again. And so when you talk about serial killers or serial predators, it's that process, I think, that causes them and fuels them to continue to repeat the behaviors. But as far as are we seeing more today, Frank, my personal opinion is we're just better at advertising and telling the world about everything that's happening around us.
Yeah, I always wondered about that, whether or not, obviously, I think you have a lot more experience in the field, but as a cultural analysis and commentator, I think that we are probably producing far more crazy than we ever have before. But on the other hand, comparing our population growth here in the country, or since, you know, say the emergence of Son of Sam or any other big headline serial killers from decades ago, you can always just say, hey, more population is going to produce more crazy, and perhaps it's all relative in some way. But I definitely think that there's some kind of cultural degradation that's enhancing and accelerating this to some degree. Where we go from that, I mean, we talk about decline in religious faith. A lot of pharmaceuticals we consume a lot of pharmaceuticals, a lot of them psychotropic, broken homes. Do you ever take into consideration those points on a person, especially once somebody's on your radar? I know for a time blaming rock music and video games was a very prominent thing. You already brought up pornography. So are these all data points that usually pop up in the profiling?
Yeah. And, you know, to avoid getting into social arguments and upsetting people about whether a two parent home is better than a one parent home. I mean, I agree with all the arguments. If a two parent home has one parent that's really caustic, I don't know that I agree that that's better. But what I found over the course of my career is in most cases, if there was a predator that was involved in serious crime, there usually was some marker in their past that led up to that. Perhaps abuse themselves or sustained criminal activity or, frankly, just a psychoanalytical problem that they have, like the inability to be apathetic or understanding or, you know, all of those things, or empathetic. And those are the things that seem to be consistent among predators. And, you know, one thing that I really think you struck an important point on is that we're seeing now a real withdrawal from faith systems. And I don't care what the faith system is. Every faith system I know of across all of Christianity, Buddhism, Judaism, Islam, they all teach that there's a higher power and there's a greater good and it's about others. And as we've watched this change that's happened, especially with, I think, a rapid acceleration through COVID where people are leaving religion, there's not a reminder or a check and balance in many psyches as they make decisions. And that's a personal feeling, but one that I've seen over the course of my career that is suggestive of people who commit crime. They become people with little or no faith. And yet here we are talking about a religious zealot who proclaimed that everything was about God. So I don't know how to even answer a question like that, I guess.
It's as complex as anything else in this world. Anything that people say is simple is usually not the case. But so has the process of profiling a killer or profiling anybody in particular changed much in the last 20 years? Is it all technological? Is it just, you know, systems based, more resources? What do you feel on that?
You know, I was fortunate to be trained by, I think, the greatest profilers in history. And one of the things that I remember being taught in the very beginning is that profiling is really an art and science mixture. And that if you think about most criminal investigations look at just some basic forms of evidence in order to prove whether something happened or not. It might be a confession from a suspect or an admission. It might be an eyewitness who saw something. And in most cases, eyewitnesses are like some of the least reliable things out there. But then you got fingerprints and DNA and physical evidence. And then now today we've got this incredible forensic evidence by being able to look at other kinds of things like technology and vehicles or cell phones or watches that can help us to put cases together. But the thing that a profiler does, Frank, that is so cool in my opinion, is a profiler kind of bundles all of that up and sits it on the shelf for a short time and looks at the case from a purely behavioral perspective. I remember being taught, and frankly, everything I say is regurgitated from pros that I learned it from. And then I've now made it intrinsic in who I am and the way I look at things. But to vicariously roll in the dirt where the predator was, to sit in the corner of a home where a homicide occurred and look at the blood spatter going up the side of a wall and trying to understand what would have created that kind of reaction, what the door lock looks like, what the words were that the predator said to the victim, and equally important, what the predator made the victim say to them as they committed these.
Well, hey, everybody, I'm Mike from Profiling Evil, and I want to share two great gift ideas for the 2023 Christmas holidays. I'm making available at a special price two of my most popular books. First is Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult, and the second is She Knew No Fear. You can purchase them individually, or you can get them at a special bundled price. And right now, as a special, I'll be signing them if you'd like. Now, Deceived is about my investigation into and the ultimate takedown of a ritual child abuse cult that was sexually abusing children, a large group of children. 12 people were ultimately convicted in this thing following a pre-dawn raid. And although the court process ended decades ago, the suffering that was endured by the children continues today. Now, I wrote this book because some of the victims asked me to tell their story. It happened during a presentation of the case on the Dr. Phil Show, as well as several other international news channels. And I was so compelled by the children asking this, now adult women, that we went ahead and wrote the book. The book doesn't reveal the horrors that the kids faced, but it acknowledges that the abuse occurred. More importantly, it's a story about how destructive cults, like this one, can be destroyed, where the system works and where the system failed in that case. And it talks about how the investigation and the prosecution literally changed the way in which cults are handled today. The book explores the cult recruiting tactics used by this particular group, and they seem to be consistent with other cults. It also talks about how we can protect our loved ones from falling prey to these perverted predators. And here's the really cool news from my perspective. Proceeds from Deceived are going toward building a new children's advocacy center. That's a place where children can be forensically and physically examined, receive physical and emotional care while being prepared for the court system. The hope is that when they walk out of the doors of a children's advocacy center, they're healthier than when they arrived. Deceived is in paperback, and it's available signed for $20. Now, my other book is She Knew No Fear, and it's a story about how I solved my great-great-grandmother's murder. She was shot and killed at a town celebration back in 1891. The story chronicles her journey from her native Scotland home to the United States. This woman walked barefooted across the plains of the United States, and she conquered the perilous Hole in the Rock expedition. She fought wild Indians, and she settled in the Four Corners area of the United States, only to be gunned down at age 40, leaving children behind. One of those children was my grandfather. Now, the book explores how I solved her murder 130 years later, and how miracles from heaven, in my opinion, guided my investigation, resulting in the discovery of my great-great-grandfather's handwritten account of the murder. If you like stories about the Wild West, family history, true crime, this is a book for you, and I think you'd really enjoy She Knew No Fear. Now listen, thanks so much for your support of Profiling Evil. You can get She Knew No Fear hardbound versions for $30, signed and delivered. Or you can get a bundle of both books for $45. And I'm happy to put a little personal inscription if you'd like that in there. But you gotta order quickly. Now thanks for all your support of Profiling Evil. And for those of you who are Christian, Merry Christmas. And for the rest, happy holidays, everyone. We'll see you soon at the next crime scene. All of those things teach us behavior. And as we look at these big pools of possible suspects in crimes, as we take that other form of evidence, behavior, it helps us to kind of, like an old gold panner, get through all the noise and get down to nuggets that really can help us determine who might most likely be responsible for something.
Well, that's one hell of a task right there, to try to to try to consider what kind of verbal exchanges were going on in the middle of an altercation or a murder, especially when there's no evidence of, there's nothing. There might be blood left behind. Obviously, there was a body in many cases, but, yeah. You know, it's just, you know, I guess a lot of that would just have to be speculation as well about just subject matter.
Well, and you know, not necessarily, because you think about it, there is verbal behavior, us talking. And if we were sitting in the same room together and I scrunched my face up and I was really angry, and you can see this now as we're having this conversation, there's nonverbal behavior. So we can start to theorize based on everything in totality, not something by itself. And, you know, when you kind of re-brought up the idea of what the predator might have had the victim say to them in the course of maybe a sexual assault or something, it all goes back to the fantasy that's driving the crime. And when you hear things and learn things that most police officers don't even think to ask about, a profiler is going to think to say, but what was motivating this offender? Why did he select this victim? And instead of going into a crime scene and saying, who done it? What we really should be doing in these kinds of cases is say, who are these victims or victim, and why did they become a victim? What was it that brought the predator and the prey together?
That's a wonderful thing to consider. Maybe it's a deep one too. And origin stories are everything. I also think, you know, you brought up DNA, and I was thinking about consumer grade technology, how DNA, from what when I've talked to other law enforcement, people in law enforcement, and everything I've read over the years and things that we've watched, it's obvious how fingerprinting, those databases that could then be nationalized, DNA, that really changed detective work forever. It exonerated a lot of people that were put on death row wrongly. I mean, those are huge things that revolutionized detective work. And then I think about, like this morning, my wife was telling me, she showed me a post from a local page somewhere that showed how some supermarkets around us are implementing palm scans as a part of their cashless self-checkout initiatives. Now, I will never scan my hand or an eye to make a purchase in my life, but it got me thinking about how advanced even consumer-grade technology is getting. And so, you know, over the last 20 years or so, has any surprising tools came in to become, you know, a really, really big boon for investigators like you? For example, how effective is, this was asked by somebody else in the audience, how effective is DNA ancestry sites like 23andMe been with solving some cold cases? Has that been happening? What kind of tools are available to you now that you didn't have 20 years ago?
Yeah, well, that's a great place to jump in. I remember down in Southern California, a woman who was murdered on Valentine's Day, and I spent some time with the investigator, and it was genealogical DNA that actually brought that thing full circle after many, many years of being cold. In California, we saw an offender brought to justice, a serial killer, because of genealogy DNA. Every single day we're seeing him. My buddy's over at Othram, a place that does nothing but look at DNA and try to put it together with cold cases, is bringing closure to families every single day. And so, I mean, what a cool time to be an investigator. What a bad time to have family blood and people who are interested in genealogy, because that database is growing and growing. And there are lots of efforts to try to stop that from being an investigative tool. But I think most people in the world would gladly have that DNA help them solve finding a missing child that disappeared 20 years ago or something else.
You know, that's a great question. A great question comes up right there is, and now that all of these tools are around, I mean, anybody can run searches throughout these DNA networks, and they're becoming a lot more publicly accessible. What about the, you know, I wouldn't call it vigilantism, because you're not going out there to exact any revenge, but what about people who are maybe drawn to more independent investigations? Do you know more and more people who are just using what's available? The internet sleuths all over the world have incredibly solved things that have seemed to be unsolvable by, you know, traditional law enforcement. What do you think about people just getting involved? They want to be involved. They have good intentions, and they're using all of their skills to try to bring some, you know, discerning light on something that has been a mystery for a while.
You know, that's been a moral question for me as I've done Profiling Evil, because I will have people reach out to me that things that would be so cool to be able to put up and get clicks out of or get new subscribers out of, and yet my conscience and my professional background say, this is something that needs to go directly to police. And so I guess that's where I draw the line. I absolutely love the fact that there's a true crime community out there that might have a different way of looking at things or a different philosophy about something. But if they truly uncover something that could solve a murder or bring a missing child home, it has no place on a YouTube channel. It first needs to go to law enforcement. And I'll tell you what, I've taken a lot of hits because of that, because people want to have a sensational program and clicks and say, I changed the world by solving this crime, but it's not their place. It needs to go to the people with authority to investigate that case.
A little bit more controversial of a question for you. What if people feel like, you know, there's justice delayed is justice denied. Maybe somebody is on a really, really hot trail and they really have something going for them. And the people they're bringing it to, sometimes, Mike, we're dealing with just pride. I've talked to cops who have said to me straight out that sometimes when they feel that just everyday people have done some kind of high quality work that seems to make them look bad. They may just not do it because, who the hell do you think you are? What if you're really onto something and you're going to the authorities and you're just not getting any attention that you know, especially if it's time sensitive? You still, what does your heart of heart tell you?
Yeah, I'm still there, Frank, for a couple of reasons. I've seen too many times when the public has socialized something that the courts prevented from coming into a trial because it's already been vetted, it's already been socialized, it's already been placed in front of the jury of public sentiment. And so, yeah, you might get it done a little faster, but if it's not done in the right way, it has no value anyway. You might feel better. You might have brought it to the forefront. You might have told the world that this person did something bad. But if it's bad and they should be held accountable for it, it needs to be done in the right order. And you know what? If you got cops that are doing that, and I know there are examples where that has happened, then you got to go to different angles. You got to go to the sheriff or to the state police or to the attorney general or the U.S. attorney general or the feds. But you got to try to do it the right way first. And again, I mean, I go back to the core motivation. If you releasing something is because you're going to be able to say on your YouTube channel, hey, breaking news, I found this. I don't know if it's really the right thing to do.
All good points. All good points. These are things that people wrestle with all the time because we're just in a time where nobody knows how far they should move the ball themselves and how much they trust they should have in the institutions out there. But really great points there.
And, you know, how would you feel, Frank, if your loved one had been murdered and you want nothing more than this person found that did this and convicted, and you want them to spend the rest of their life behind bars, and some galump comes along and shares something that breaks the case wide open, but it's never admitted into court because of the way it was handled. I mean, has it really helped anyone?
I can see that. The one thing that we have learned over the last few years alone is how easy it is to have really high value evidence just get thrown away because of the way it's been handled. Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. By cops as well, by the way. I mean, you know, they screw up and release it, or they don't tell anyone about it right away, or they're holding it close to the cuff and they haven't cataloged it correctly. I mean, this goes both ways, and I love the policing profession, but it would be crazy to say we don't have mistakes and it's not an evolving, learning business.
You brought something up before. You're talking about cold cases. Made me just wonder, how old is too old of a cold case?
you know, well, thank you for asking that, because I always like to pat myself on the back. A FBI profiler and I were hired by the Discovery Channel to look into the death of King Tut.
Oh, that's old.
That's a cold, cold case. you're talking 1300 BC, so what, 3,200 years ago. And we spent several months several years going back and forth to Egypt and working with the world's premier Egyptologists and forensic examiners. And we were finally actually granted the ability to go in and spend time with Tut in his tomb. And I just remember thinking, what is this old sour cop doing sitting in King Tut's tomb? But we came up with what we believed was a murder case, and we presented it to a group of Egyptologists in Washington, D.C., and it became an Emmy Award-winning film with Discovery Channel, and we had a blast. And so I always kind of laugh because I say, well, if you can solve a murder case at 3,000 years old, we ought to be able to solve the one that happened 20 years ago.
You'd think so. You'd think so. But that's just crazy. So there's a very, very small audience of people. You, a partner, and King Tut's body. Just right. That's it.
Absolutely incredible. In fact, on one particular moment in that investigation, this was just shortly after the collapse of the towers at 9/11. It was in the middle of Ramadan, and we were in Amarna, Egypt, which is in the middle of nowhere. It's a place where King Tut's dad, a guy named Akhenaten, had moved his family and was trying to keep from getting murdered because he changed the belief system from the Amun priesthood to a monotheistic kind of a belief system. And we went into a tomb that hadn't been opened in 40 years. It was discovered and immediately closed up. But as we were climbing through the tomb, there were bones, there were artifacts, and we walked into a room. And if you remember the Indiana Jones film where that big ball rolls through the,
oh yeah,
through the building, we walked into a room and there was a big cement ball up on a block, and it really freaked me out because I started thinking of all the mummy movies. But what we learned was that they actually started in those rooms chipping away, and the easiest thing to do would be to chip the walls down into a ball and then push the ball out of the temple. So it made perfect sense now all of a sudden why the ball was in the Temple of Doom.
Oh, gotcha. Because me, yeah, my first thought would be do not touch anything.
Exactly.
Don't touch
Wait
anything.
For the darts and those beetles that are going to crawl in your skin.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Blow on everything. You know, you want to make sure there's no strings attached. Oh, boy.
Well, that's that's where you let the guide go into the room first, too, by the way.
Yes.
You say, oh, no, please, after you.
After you. I'm just going to stand back here. Oh, man. Well, that is one heck of an adventure. You know, so that they're cold cases. Then let's talk about... I know that you cover a lot of open cases, ones that are still being, you know, they're developing right now on your channel. A lot of people come to do deep dives on publicly available information. Let's start with one that is a little bit closer to home over here in New York. That's the Long Island serial killer. That's Rex Huerman. Any updates on this case? Last I heard, I mean, we were talking about the police officer out there who was crooked, had a lot of issues, but he was linked. This Rex guy was linked to four victims, but those four, that's four of 11, if I believe the 11 that was discovered years ago. So I've always wondered, is this all the work of one man, or is it a fraternity of killers that just found a common dumping spot? What do you think so far? Are we getting any closer to understanding that?
You know, I've actually been following the Long Island serial killer case for about a decade. I did some work with and some shows with A&E on the Long Island serial killer where we were exploring some of the characteristics there. And the thing that I find interesting is I'm one of those people that don't believe, for instance, Shannon Gilbert, the woman who was found that really sprung in to this investigation, the discovery of the four women at Gilgo Beach. I don't believe that Shannon Gilbert was the victim of a serial killer. Some people really disagree with me, but behaviorally, it just doesn't fit. The thing that's interesting about those bodies that are discovered out on Gilgo and Long Island is that that group of three and possibly four that Huerman will probably face in court all had very similar kinds of things about the way the bodies were disposed, the locations, the methodology, the DNA. Those things are pretty hard to overcome. But when you start thinking about those other bodies, I mean, you have the Asian male who it could have been that he, Huerman, if he is responsible for this, thought he was picking up a woman, discovered it was a man, flew into a rage and murdered this young man. Or it could be completely something different. And these outliers, you got to think about. There were bodies that were cut up and mutilated, cut into pieces and deposited in different locations. And they were many, many years apart. So you start thinking about if it is the same predator, then has the predator evolved? Have they gone through a process? Maybe in those early days when body parts were being cut up and disposed in multiple locations, it was a predator who was a little more agile, a little more wary and trying to move evidence around to make it more possible that they'd get away with it. And then they got away with it for 10 years and thought, I don't have to work that hard. And so they just start putting them in a burlap bag and dumping them. So you got to start thinking about those kinds of things. And this is where this case will become more relevant as we learn what was recovered in Huerman's home in the search if they find DNA from those other victims. We know that there's forensic DNA to the three and possibly four. We know that there are other kinds of evidence to put those in the same place, like eyewitness and others. So you got to kind of take them into account that way. But our first knee-jerk reaction is, he's a serial killer. He's got to be responsible for all of them. We may not be.
Right. Right. And that's the first thing I thought about. Was this a fraternity of killers, or could it just have become a common dumping ground or something that, people who are in the business of, disposing of human life like this, they just look for areas that are this marshy, secluded. It's just, you want to talk about data points, might just be a place that is often sought out for people like this. I don't know. But,
you're absolutely right. And you think about the displacement that occurs from predation, animals that might pick up a part of a body and carry it somewhere else to consume it, and that transfers it. And yet we come up with these wild ideas that, oh no, the predator's purposely doing these kinds of things. Or is tidal influence bringing in body parts that otherwise wouldn't? And is that a collector because tide happens to push in that direction? So you got to take all these things into consideration that, frankly, with Long Island, I don't know enough about. I've studied the tidal waters and others, trying to see if I could come up with some ideas there. But those are the kinds of things that at least a good investigator, in my opinion, is constantly evaluating. And it's just too easy to just say, oh yeah, it's the same guy.
Yeah, I know. Well, let's move on to another one. Almost like rapid fire this, because we're running out of time. The four students who were killed in Idaho, the Idaho Fours that they're called in the media. I haven't done a lick of this on the show, but I would love to see a crash course time from you. Where is that at right now? Because last I did hear is that the defense was stalling, and there's a lot of slow moving aspects of that trial. The suspect's name and what happened.
So yeah, the suspect in that is Brian Koberger, and he actually was a Northeasterner, but he was going to school 11 miles west of where the college students were killed. He was a criminal justice graduate student. So that is always kind of an interesting thing to kind of think through. But the crux of the entire case is that these four students were brutally murdered, that a witness saw the predator as he was leaving the home. She lived, and it's unknown whether the predator saw her and was just tired. Because I'll tell you what, Frank, I've seen video, especially in the prison system, of people stabbing people to death. And it's messy, hard work. Killing someone is not an easy thing. And to kill four people, that predator had to have been exhausted by the time they left, and obviously made mistakes like leaving the sheath to his knife behind, and other evidence that will come out in the course of this case. He has forensic evidence that's against him right now. And his argument simply is, I wasn't there. I drove past there, but I was just out for a drive. And I happened to turn my phone off while I was out for a drive so that it couldn't be tracked. And my DNA was discovered in the home, but I had nothing to do with it. So this one's going to really boil down to getting through all of this noise that the defense is creating, getting into trial, and the prosecution putting on the case to say why this kid was there and if he is responsible, holding him accountable. But a horrendous case. The questions come up, did he intend on killing all four? My personal opinion is that he had a preferential target in there, and that everyone else was collateral damage that he had to just clean up.
Oh. Well, I'm almost glad that I didn't follow that case now that I got the crash course. I mean, this must weigh on you after a while. I know it weighs on people. They need to take breaks. People always have to take tolerance breaks for all this stuff. But someone in your situation, Man, this must, you have to have a certain type of constitution to keep going, especially for 40 years. Let me ask you this. This one came in from an audience member who lives near Austin, Texas. Says, does Mike know anything about the Rainy Street Killer? Young men have been turning up dead in Lady Bird Lake just off of Rainy Street for over a decade now, and I believe about 12 have turned up just in the last year, leading to an arrest that was made in February, I think. It's all been very hush-hush. Anything about that, Mike?
Yeah, well, I know that police department well. I've actually been in that building many, many times. I helped them with some of their crime analysis solutions and some of the mapping that they do there. And the thing that I find interesting in that case, number one, who wouldn't be concerned if you got dead bodies showing up? I think five dead bodies that have showed up in that stretch of river. So the question that I start going to is, there are only two outliers that I know of. One victim they've released that I'm aware of, if I remember right, had blunt force trauma to the face and maybe another part on his body, potentially had been in a fist fight or something near the bar area along the river. And police are saying that he drowned. Now, he could have been beat up and thrown in the river, and that's a murder even though he drowned. So I don't want to discount that. But then they released the autopsy on the latest victim, if I remember right. And in that autopsy, they determined that he clearly did drown. He still had his wallet with him. He had his watch on. He was dressed in his clothing, and that he was probably drinking and fell in the river and drowned. I don't know what the others were like. So that's really what becomes important. Again, like I said early on in the show, the victimology, who's the victim and why did they become a victim? And I think that as this case unfolds, we'll see whether they had their personal items stolen from them, or if they recovered them in the river with their items with them, if there was any nexus that tied them back to something like buying narcotics from certain people. Those are the kinds of things that will bring this together to help us understand if it's a serial predator. I think they've clearly identified that it's not the serial predator, that the Latino man that they were looking at for other things in the area. So again, I always go back to this idea. Let's, before we jump to a idea like serial killer, let's see if we can explain some of the things and what brought those people together in space and time. And if it's okay, I'd like to just talk a little bit about risk, if I could.
Oh, yeah, by all means.
One of the things that I really try to spend a lot of time on Profiling Evil talking about is not assigning blame when someone's victimized, because a person who's sexually assaulted, in no circumstance, regardless of whether they're a drug addict or anything else, deserves to be victimized. But we have to recognize that we are all willing to take certain levels of risk in our behavior, and that that risk can place us into positions where we might be victimized. For instance, I was working on a case in Australia where the bikey group, the bikers, were going to bars and they were watching for drunk people to come out and try to get money out of the ATM. And they were capturing the ATM code and then stealing the guy's ID and then either beating him up or just waiting and going in and taking more money. Well, no question, he's still a victim of robbery if they take his property from him. He's still a victim of fraud if they're using the ATM wrongly, but he owns some responsibility by being drunk out in the middle of the night with people around, standing at an ATM trying to get things. And I oftentimes reflect on something my wife told me once. We were walking out of a mall at 9 o'clock at night, and she said, "What do you think about when you're walking out of the mall?" And my response was, you know, like, are we going to stop and grab a burger on the way home? Or I wonder what I'll watch when I get home on TV. And I said, what do you think about? And she says, I'm looking at every man in the parking lot. I'm trying to figure out if my car's under a street light or if it's in the dark. And that's the difference. We can do a better job of reducing our own chance of being victimized by assessing our risk that we're willing to take every day in every activity we do.
We talk about that a lot on this show in obviously less official ways, situational awareness. And it goes a long way, and I definitely talk a lot about that with my own wife. To, where are you going today, where you intend to go this week, based on where she wants to go and what she wants to do. I insist I go with her to certain places. And it's just one of those things. It's just one of those things. I really appreciate it. And, that's the daunting thing, Mike, is that all the work that you do and all the people out there who do what you do, the what is left unsolved, what is open right now, the caseload is innumerable, and it must be just really hard to keep your optimism when you're tasked with essentially fighting the tide like this. It sounds like this work can be like trying to part the Red Sea with a tablespoon at times, just because of how much is being committed and how much effort and how many resources could actually reasonably allocated to fighting it all and solving it all and putting it right. But I really thank you for the time here tonight. And in whatever final thoughts you have, you can let people know how they can follow you. I have your URL is in the description of the episode.
Obviously, thank you.
There's the YouTube channel. You have a really nice loyal following over there. Tell everybody how to follow your work on a day-to-day basis.
Well, thank you, Frank, and thanks for the chance to chat. I mean, it's just been really enjoyable, and I appreciate that. And folks, just at Profiling Evil, just look it up. It'll take you to YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and then watch for me on Court TV and News Nation, and I'm on weekly talking about whatever the hottest criminal case is out there. So it'll be really fun to communicate with y'all. And Frank, I got to get you on Profiling Evil.
Oh, geez. I don't know what I would contribute, but I would love to hang out with you anytime, Mike. You let me know, and hopefully we can have you back on again to follow up on some of these open cases, especially if you write another book. You got friends over here in New York, and thank you for all the time tonight.
Thank you, Frank.
All right. Have a good night. There you go, everybody. There is Mr. Mike King, Profiling Evil. And I think that we just wrapped that up in a perfect little, as profilingevil.com. Oh, I linked the YouTube on the YouTube description, but let me just profilingevil.com. Make sure that I get that in there so that later on, there is no two ways about it. People are going to exactly good. Save off. Nice. Wow, how'd you like that? How did you like that? That's a little something for you. I mean, I just always think about stuff like that, and the people who are doing it day in, day out. Takes a strong constitution, as I said, personal constitution. Let's get to some super chats, make sure that we get everything in before we end a little bit early. We got a couple of minutes to go, but it's the finale, book club. Got to do some work over there. Extra content, creating value. Become a sponsor and start reading. Jay Britt says, hey, Frank, I'm really liking Mike King. You should get him back. You're the man. Oh, I would love to have Mike King back. Would love to, especially if there's breaking news on whatever, any kind of front on any open cases, big trials, whatever the hell it is. And there's so much more. So,
well, I want to express my appreciation to Frank and his entire team and take a moment now to wish all of you the very happiest of Thanksgivings. Now, I hope that you're surrounded by friends, family, and loved ones, and that you use the upcoming month of December as a time of personal reflection. Find balance, get away from true crime, and spend a little more time with family and things that are hopefully a whole lot more uplifting. Now, family can be challenging. I hope that December's a time of kindness, a time of outreach for you, and a time of bridge building. You know, we've become awfully mean in this world, and the only way we're going to change our destructive behaviors is by being kinder, gentler, and more inclusive. Now, if you're a person of faith, I hope that during the month of December, your personal testimony increases. I hope you'll find this a time to lift others, and I hope you'll find time during the holiday season to not only lift others, but for those of you that believe in God, I hope that you'll find time to lift your eyes heavenward and show gratitude for the many blessings that you're enjoying. Pray for the many people who suffer and continue to look for some balance in your lives so that you might be the kind of person who's offering hope rather than despair. That you might be the kind of person that's offering goodness rather than evil. That you might be the kind of person that's inclusive rather than divisive. Hey, thanks for a great 2023, and hopefully we're going to get together on a live before the year comes to an end. I'll maybe send a few pictures from some Christmas villages in Austria or something, and we'll have a chance to talk, I hope. But until then, thanks so much for your support of Profiling Evil. We'll see you soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.